Hey, it's Aaron Blake. I write the Campaign Moment newsletter for The Washington Post. You've probably heard me on Fridays on Post Reports talking about the latest news from the 2024 campaign. Well, we've got a bonus episode in the Campaign Moment podcast feed today. It's a great conversation with my colleague Roz Helderman. We talk about the Manhattan criminal trial of former President Donald Trump and what it might mean for his campaign. You can find that bonus episode by looking up the Campaign Moment podcast wherever you're listening. And please be sure to hit follow so you don't miss any future bonus episodes. All right, we'll get on with today's episode of Post Reports.
Over the last week, student protests over Israel's war in Gaza have intensified. Tent encampments have been popping up at universities across the U.S.
We're seeing protests really coast to coast at public and private universities, at small colleges and large colleges, including the University of Michigan, Berkeley, Yale.
This is what community looks like!
New York University, University of Minnesota, Columbia.
Susan Sverluga reports on higher education at The Post, and she has been speaking with protesters about their demands and hearing from other students and faculty about what it's like to be on their campuses now. Hundreds of students have been arrested at several universities, some at Columbia and NYU.
There are really many, many places students are responding and putting up encampments or having other kinds of protests in support of Palestinian rights and in support of the students who were arrested. I think there's a lot of political pressure on universities. There's lawmakers are scrutinizing their decisions because they're hearing about rise in campus anti-Semitism, and there's a lot of concern about that. I think it's become a politically volatile issue. Obviously, the war is very emotional and very hard for many people in this country, and students are responding in emotional ways to that.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Wednesday, April 24th. Today, we hear more about the students' demands and how universities are struggling over how to respond. So, Susan, tell me, what are these students demanding as part of these protests?
Several things, and it does vary from campus to campus. They're speaking out in favor of Palestinian rights and free Palestine. They want a ceasefire. They want to make people know about what's happening in Gaza, which they believe is a genocide. They call it genocide. And many want their universities to divest from any investments that may be connected to Israel, to weapons manufacturers. Some are asking for an end to academic partnerships with Israel, relief from the sanctions that have been imposed on students. So students who have been disciplined, they're asking that those decisions be overturned.
I think it's worth pausing here to just point out that Israel does deny that it is carrying out genocide in Gaza. But a case brought before the International Court of Justice alleges that Israel is violating international law by committing and failing to prevent genocidal acts. But just to go back to what you were saying earlier about divestment, that is one of those words that I hear thrown around a lot, but I'm not sure that everyone understands how that works, how divestment has worked in the past. So can you explain a little bit more of when these students call for their tuition money to not be used in Israel? Like, how are they asking for this money to be divested? And what does that mean in terms of what Israel wouldn't be getting?
So university endowments are pretty complicated with a lot of investments, some of which are public and some of which are not in many cases. And students, research where this money is being invested and try to find out which companies are involved and may benefit from, the very large assets of some of these universities. And so they're asking that the university's endowment not support companies that they feel are in any way connected with Israel or with weapons companies, and that the money be diverted into other funds that are more neutral. One of my colleagues spoke at length with a student protester at Yale.
My name is Tacey Hutton. I use she, her, hers pronouns. I am a sophomore at Yale College.
And she was explaining how important the issue of divestment is for them.
Ultimately, our goal here is a free Palestine. Secondary to that, we want to end Yale's complicity in the ongoing occupation and genocide. And that means divesting all of its endowment money, all of its funds from weapons manufacturing and war.
You know, Yale has a very large endowment. And so I think the students feel that the university is complicit in what's happening in Gaza, and that students' tuition money is therefore going and having an impact on what's happening in Gaza on civilians there.
We're students here day in, day out. We go to classes, we do our homework, we take our exams. All the while, the university that we're giving our money to, that we're giving our time and energy and labor to, is sending the bombs that are leveling every university, school, hospital in Gaza. And for a university that claims to stand for higher education and, you know, the production of knowledge, that is just, you know, utterly despicable and contradictory to everything they claim to stand for. Me as a student, I refuse to consent to that. I'm not willing to stand here, stand by, stay silent as Yale just continues on with the status quo.
When I hear about this, the one thing that comes to mind is the divestment campaign in the 80s, right? When you had a lot of college students who were protesting against apartheid in South Africa, calling for their universities to divest from South Africa in a way that actually ended up, you know, being pretty effective in putting pressure on the South African government. I mean, do these students see that as a model for what they're trying to do here now?
They do. In fact, many of those student protesters see what's happening in Gaza as a form of apartheid and feel like it's incredibly important to that the university not in any way support that. And there have been other divestment campaigns over the years on other issues. Some universities have divested from companies that profit from fossil fuels, for example.
Interesting. So, Susan, I know that you've been reporting specifically on the protests at Columbia, which are one of the largest campus protests that we're seeing right now. Can you tell me a little bit about what you've seen there, their decision to, like, form this encampment, and some of what you've heard from students there?
Sure. Yeah, Columbia has a unique position right now because Republican lawmakers are leading an investigation into campus anti-Semitism, and that's at several universities. Columbia is one of them. Three of the other universities' presidents were previously called before to testify before that committee. And it went extremely badly and got a lot of attention in part because the presidents repeatedly, they gave answers that were very cautious, and they repeatedly declined to say that that calls for the genocide of Jews would be a violation of their campus policies, which, of course, shocked many people.
I will ask you one more time. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric.
And is it anti-Semitic rhetoric?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric when it crosses into conduct that amounts to bullying, harassment, intimidation. That is actionable conduct, and we do take action.
So the answer is yes, that calling for the genocide of Jews violates Harvard Code of Conduct, correct?
Again, it depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
Two of the presidents later resigned, the president of Penn and the president of Harvard, in part because of these comments and all the publicity that came from this sort of disastrous hearing. So this committee summoned Columbia's president to testify last week, and she went with several other university leaders and faced a lot of tough questions from lawmakers about what Columbia has been doing to prevent anti-Semitism on campus.
When mobs or people are shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine must be free, or long live the Infantada, are those anti-Semitic statements? Yes or no? It's not how you feel, it's...
I hear them as such. Some people don't. We have sent
a
clear message.
So is that yes?
We have sent a clear message to our
community. I'm not asking about the message. Yeah. Is that fall under definition of anti-Semitic behavior, yes or no? Why is it so tough?
while they immediately all said that, yes, calls for the genocide of Jews on their campus would be a violation of campus policies, they expressed a lot of concern themselves about anti-Semitism at Columbia. And among the questions were what the university is doing to enforce its policies. So she spoke about discipline for students and some of the investigations into faculty statements on campus.
And depending on the nature of the incident, there are consequences ranging from people being potentially suspended, being forced to get educated and trained about anti-Semitism.
And while they were testifying, students on campus who support Palestinian rights were setting up a tent encampment at the center of campus. And that just touched off a much more visible protest. It wasn't authorized. Columbia had recently put in place policies requiring students to ask for permission to protest 2 days in advance and to remain in a central location. That was an attempt to, university said, to have some limits on these protests to avoid protests taking over academic buildings or interrupting classrooms, and to sort of create a space where if students were very upset by the speech at the protests, they could presumably, in at least some cases, avoid the area and not have to hear it. But some of the tough questions that they were asking, lawmakers were asking, university leaders were, why didn't you shut down an unauthorized protest just days ago? And so when this unauthorized protest that was happening, even as they were testifying, I would assume quite uncomfortable for university leaders. And I assume they felt pressure from, you know, all these questions from lawmakers, and knowing that the hearing closed with lawmakers saying that they had heard good answers, that Columbia leaders had been saying the right things, but that they needed to see action and they needed to see that the words were backed up.
And so that it seems like that has led to some of the escalation we've seen in recent days in terms of how this protest has continued and gotten bigger, but also in terms of how the university has responded to this encampment and this demonstration. Can you talk a little bit about that, like what's transpired over these last couple of days?
Yeah, that's right. So the university pretty quickly began sending messages to the protesters that their encampment wasn't authorized and that it wasn't safe and that they would have to leave the area. And they gave repeated warnings. But the day after the hearing, they called in NYPD to clear the protesters. And that move, I think, shocked a lot of people on campus. It just felt like a rapid escalation of enforcement that I think many students and faculty hadn't expected. And I think students described officers come on campus and take their classmates away in cuffs when they felt, you know, their classmates were just making a, you know, principled statement and trying to raise awareness about an important issue. Laura Noor Walton, a student journalist at Columbia, saw these arrests happening and spoke to one of my colleagues about what she saw.
There was, of course, outrage. And certainly I was standing around the fence as the arrests were happening, and there were hordes of people just watching what was happening. Students were watching as their friends and peers got taken away in zip ties by the New York Police Department. People were sobbing and screaming, and some were just paralyzed, unable to move or do anything. It was a very charged environment. People who were watching this happen were pretty dismayed at the treatment of their peers.
What is the university's rationale for arresting these students? And what have they said about the fact that they took steps that I think people weren't expecting them to take up until a few days ago?
They said that they had given repeated warnings, been very clear that people could continue to protest in other ways. There were approved ways to protest, that they value free speech and they value the right of students to protest, but that this encampment was unsafe and that students involved in it had disregarded multiple requests that they stop this particular form of protest.
I want to point out here that we did reach out directly to the universities that we're talking about at more length here. We reached out to Yale. They didn't respond to us. When we reached out to Columbia, they didn't make anyone available to speak with us, but they did send us a statement by the Columbia president. And I want to talk about that statement because there's this line. Quote, "The current encampment violates all of the new policies, severely disrupts campus life, and creates a harassing and intimidating environment for many of our students," end quote. And that last part of that line is what I'm curious about, this idea that the protest is creating a harassing and intimidating environment. What is the Columbia president referring to here? And what have you heard about how these encampments have been seen as threatening or as harassing?
I just want to start by saying that there are quite a few Jewish students who have joined the pro-Palestinian protest. But there are also many Jewish students who are very supportive of Israel, even though many don't support all of Israel's policies and may be very concerned about what's happening in Gaza. But many Jewish students there who support Israel have been very upset, have described real fear and concern about the words that are used at some of these protests and the slogans that they have repeatedly said, you know, this to me and to my friends and my family and my culture is a call for the eradication of Israel or an end to the Israeli state. What you're saying now or the sign you're holding just says to me that Jews are not welcome on this campus. And they feel like those raising those concerns, the university didn't take those concerns as seriously as they should have. And some described conversations with pro-Palestinian protesters who said words like intifada just, you know, literally means revolution in Arabic. And that's all that they're saying when they say that.
I just want to jump in here. We have some tape from a counter-protester who talks about this idea. His name is Isidore Carton. He spoke with a student journalist at Columbia. Isidore is 23 years old. He graduated from Columbia, and he also served in the Israel Defense Forces. And he says that in 1996, his uncle was killed by Hamas while serving in the Israeli army. So let's listen to a little bit of his tape.
I think it's abhorrent that there are students that are disrupting people's access to education, that there are long lines to get into class, that people, I mean, everyone pays a tuition to be here. I think it's disgusting, and especially what they're standing for. They're standing for, I mean, I saw on the tent of one of the people when I walked in the words, Intifada, Intifada, Intifada. I mean, my uncle was kidnapped and murdered by Hamas terrorists in the second Intifada. And if they knew what they were saying, I don't know how they'd be so supportive of that.
I think there was a sense from some of these students as well that the protests are so large and so pervasive that it's just hard to avoid. It's, you know, when I was on campus, it was the chants were literally echoing off the buildings and in the center of campus. So even though it had been confined to a certain place, a certain very public place, you know, many students described just not being able to get to class without hearing this. And many of the protesters are masked, wearing keffiyehs or other or surgical masks because they're concerned about discipline. But some Jewish students described to me feeling, you know, sort of intimidated by this, the anonymity of it, and just feeling like there are people sort of glaring at them or hostile to them, even who, you know, maybe they're classmates or people that they see in the dining hall and they don't know who they are.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the different ways of seeing that language, because we've had conversations on the podcast in the past about how, you know, phrases like from the river to the sea, right? Like to two different groups, that means two very different things. And what some people see as a kind of cry for the rights of Palestinians, other people see as a call for like the end of Israel. But I'm curious if you had conversations with these protesters about what they have to say in response to some of the concerns raised, particularly by Jewish students or faculty who have felt harassed or threatened by these protests. Like, do the demonstrators like see that? Do they like grapple with concerns that they are creating a like hostile environment to their classmates?
I can't speak to what they're feeling inside or whether they're grappling with it, but what they've expressed is a feeling that they're being asked to censor their words in a way that's unfair and inappropriate, and that there's an attempt to control pro-Palestinian speech that you wouldn't find for another group. And that they also feel, I think, some sense of frustration that, you know, anti-Zionism is being conflated with anti-Semitism, and they're criticizing Israeli policies, and that's protected political speech and should be allowed. And I've also heard frustration that, you know, they feel like they are trying to raise awareness about genocide and deaths of civilians, and that other students are saying that words bother them, that this, you know, that phrases are concerning to them. I think there's some pro-Palestinian protesters who feel that what's happening in Gaza is just so important that they have to just speak the truth that they're seeing.
After the break, we hear how university officials are navigating the larger political pressure of this moment. We'll be right back.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters? And why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat, available now.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We've seen concerns from students on a lot of different campuses about the potential of censorship. In particular, this has come up at the University of Southern California, USC. Tell me a little bit about what's happened there.
Yeah, their valedictorian would typically speak at graduation. Their valedictorian this year is Muslim and pro-Palestinian. And they asked her not to speak because they said they were worried about keeping the event safe. That raised a lot of concerns from her classmates and others that her speech was being censored unfairly. On top of that, they also canceled many of the other outside commencement speakers.
What are some of the other ways that we're seeing students protesting?
We're seeing a lot of encampments right now in support of the encampment at Columbia that resulted in the arrests. And some of the encampments that have sprung up have also resulted in arrests, like some at Yale on Monday, and at NYU, New York University, on Monday, also that night, and on Tuesday at the University of Minnesota. We've also seen hunger strikes. There was a hunger strike at Yale that recently concluded. And at Cal Poly Humboldt's, students took over a building and barricaded themselves inside of it. And school officials have shut down the campus through Wednesday.
And is there an expectation that this is going to continue to escalate in the coming days?
I think it will probably continue to escalate in coming days because there are very strong feelings about both the issue, you know, about Gaza and what's happening there and about how universities are responding and what many students see as overly harsh crackdowns and, a police response to students' protests, I think, is something that's upsetting both students and faculty. We have seen some faculty response as well. There was a faculty walkout at Columbia on Monday in support of students' right to protest, essentially.
Oh, interesting. Like, basically that they were unhappy about seeing the students arrested and that they support their right to be able to be out there.
Exactly.
But also, we're coming on to graduation, or I guess at least the end of the semester when students are going to be leaving campus, presumably. Is there a sense that there's kind of a potential hard stop to this once the academic term wraps up and, like, everyone will just go home?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll be a hard stop because I think there may be, it may resume in the fall, but I do think this feels to me like a final push before finals and before students leave after graduation or after finals.
I think for a lot of people right now, there's a sense of history repeating itself, that college campuses have always been at the heart of social movements, particularly anti-war protests, like from Vietnam through the present, that you've seen that play out on campuses so many times. But I think in some ways this also feels different. So what is your sense of, like, how these protests reflect this moment that we are in as a country?
I think that country is really polarized, and these protests reflect that. There's some very wide gulf between the two sides and a sort of unwillingness in many cases to hear the other side's points. The beliefs are very strongly held. And so if you deeply believe that there is a genocide in Gaza, you may feel, deeply compelled to do something to stop that genocide or call it out.
This is not a Yale issue. This is not a Yale and Columbia issue. Ultimately, this is a global issue. This is about Gaza. This is about 34,000 plus dead and so many more displaced and brutalized.
And on the flip side, if you feel like, your classmates are, anti-Semitic, or that, Jewish people are not being treated fairly on campus or listened to, you may feel like it's very hard to understand where the other side is coming from.
We never wanted this war. But if these people really cared about Palestinian civilians, they'd be supporting Israel.
In a lot of past protests that we've seen, there's been students calling for change against some outside force or against the administration. So, they want to end climate change, or they want to see the administration do something different, lower tuition or some other cause. And in this case, it's really dividing students on campuses in many cases and faculty on campuses. It feels more personal. And I think the divides reflect national divides. And I think they feel very deep on many campuses.
Susan, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Susan Sverluga covers higher education for The Post. On Wednesday afternoon, House Speaker Mike Johnson visited Columbia's campus. He called on the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, to resign. For failing, he said, to quickly dismantle pro-Palestinian encampments on campus grounds. Before we go, here are a few other stories I'm keeping my eye on today. The White House has announced that it will immediately send a substantial weapons package to Ukraine, including badly needed air defense systems and artillery.
I'm making sure the shipments start right away. In the next few hours, literally the few hours, we're going to begin sending in equipment to Ukraine for for air defense munitions, for artillery, for rocket systems, and armored vehicles.
This comes after the Senate passed a foreign aid bill last night, which Biden signed into law on Wednesday morning. $61 billion will be sent to Ukraine. And there's $26 billion in funding for Israel and humanitarian aid in Gaza and other places. Also, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments today about whether the Biden administration can penalize hospitals that fail to provide emergency abortions, even in states with strict abortion bans. The federal law at the center of this case is called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. It requires hospitals to provide anyone with an emergency medical condition the care needed to stabilize them. Biden administration officials say that they need the authority to protect abortions in emergencies. And they've cited abortion bans in states that have confused healthcare workers and patients and delayed life-saving treatment. But in court today, the conservative justices seemed skeptical, and they pushed back on the Biden administration's interpretation of this law. Justice Samuel Alito, for example, suggested that the federal government cannot force private hospitals that receive federal funds to violate a state's law.
The theory is Congress can tell a state or any other entity or person, look, here's some money or other thing of value, and if you want to accept it, fine, then you have to accept certain conditions. But how does the Congress's ability to do that authorize it to impose duties on another party that has not agreed to accept this money?
And finally, don't forget that we have a bonus episode of The Campaign Moment today, a deep dive into the latest on the Trump trial. To listen to that, search for The Campaign Moment in your podcast app and subscribe. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Sabi Robinson and Renny Svernovsky. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Monica Campbell. Thank you also to Hannah Natanson, April Bethay, and Angelica Ong. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.